in order to attend a court hearing previously, when courts were fully physical and in person, you know, you had to take off of work, you had to arrange for childcare, you had to travel to the courthouse, you had to pay for parking. And having a virtual option really eases some of those both financial and time burdens.
Today on Law Next, how courts met the pandemic challenge. A study just released by the Pew Charitable Trusts examined how state courts in the United States responded to the pandemic in their handling of civil cases. And it found that courts rapidly embraced technology and revolutionized their operations. But it also found that courts' technology choices hindered participation for some people who were not represented by lawyers. To discuss this report, I am joined today by Kutsiya Naki, a lawyer and member of the Civil Legal System Modernization team at Pew that conducted this research and produced the report. This is Bob Ambrogi, and you are listening to Law Next, the podcast that features the innovators and entrepreneurs who are driving what's next in law. Before we get to today's interview, a quick note about the sponsors whose generosity makes this show possible. Paradigm is changing the legal landscape with their three industry-leading practice management solutions, Practice Panther, Bill for Time, and Meriscase, and the online payment solution, Headnote. In the office or on the go, more than 40,000 lawyers trust Paradigm to automate and grow their practice. Learn more at joinparadigm.com. Now, on to today's interview. Kutsiya, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Bob.
It's a pleasure to speak with you. Really fascinating report. I was really interested to read it. But before we even start talking about that, I'm going to mention that you also have a podcast. So here's an opportunity. You want to give it a plug to our listeners?
Sure. Thank you so much, Bob. So my podcast is called Down to the Struts, and it is about disability, design, and intersectionality. You can find it at www.downtothestruts.com on most podcast platforms, Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, etc. And we do have a presence on social media, on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And incidentally, on January 18th, 2022, I'll be interviewing Erica Rickard, the project director of the Pew Civil Legal System Modernization Project, about this report. So please feel free to stay. If you want to learn more about this report, you can listen into that episode.
Well, I look forward to listening to that. I've known Erica since she was Equal Justice Coordinator in Massachusetts many years ago and worked at Harvard's Access to Justice program as well before she came to Pew. So somebody I really respect very highly and respect the work that she does. So I look forward to that interview. So again, before we talk about the report, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and about the work that you and others do in the Civil Legal System Modernization Project at Pew?
Thanks for that. As you mentioned, I work on this team, and our project is focused on modernizing our civil courts. And we do that in a couple of ways. So one is to use research, data, and evidence to understand how the civil legal system works and to make recommendations about how to make it more open, efficient, and equitable for people, particularly people who use the civil legal system without a lawyer. We also engage with partners, stakeholders on the ground, policymakers at the state and local level to engage in this process of court modernization. And finally, we also engage with the philanthropic community to elevate the conversation about the need to reform the civil legal system.
So right there, what you're doing is already somewhat, I don't know, radical in the sense that that idea of applying research, data, and evidence to what courts do is something that courts themselves haven't done a very good job at over the years, is it? Not to get you in trouble right away.
Courts, I can answer your question and then we can cut this whole little dialogue out. But, courts have historically not collected a lot of data. So for example, we released a report in 2020 that focused on debt collection lawsuits in particular. Yeah. It was called How Debt Collectors Are Transforming the Business of State Courts. And you can find it on pewtrust.org, as well as the report that we're here to talk about today about court technology. And, you know, we found it, you know, most courts don't collect comprehensive data, we found, on debt collection lawsuits in order to enable people to understand who is being sued, what are the outcomes of their cases. So that's been a challenge, but that courts are trying to address. The National Center for State Courts, which is a sort of a governing body for the state courts across the country, is working on developing data standards for courts to try to create some sort of uniformity in the types of data that courts collect so we can understand more and look under the hood of court systems.
Right. And I know, I think this report that we're talking about today alludes to the fact that the Conference of Chief Justices and the the Conference of Court Administrators or something like that. I'm not saying the name right, but they have both called for better data collection for courts as well, or even before the pandemic struck, I believe.
That's definitely true.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's talk about this. So the report is titled How Courts Embrace Technology, Met the Pandemic Challenge, and Revolutionized Their Operations. So the title's a little bit of a giveaway right there, I guess, in terms of how well courts did in responding to the pandemic and the onset of COVID-19. But what was it that you set out to do in conducting this study? What was it? Why did you want to conduct this study in the first place?
Our project, and I was sharing a little bit about it earlier, you know, one of the components when it launched in 2018 was to look at two particular types of technology. And it was focused on this idea of technology as the wave of the future for courts. And it had real potential in increasing access and maximizing participation in the legal system. So we started out looking at two specific technologies: online dispute resolution, which had started proliferating in courts in 2014, which is a way for people to resolve disputes entirely online without having to go to a courthouse at all. And then legal information portals, which are, you know, web-based portals where people can look for legal information online and find accurate, reliable information that they need that's in, you know, plain language and is clear to understand. And in 2020, as the pandemic became a reality, courthouse doors had to shutter, we saw courts just rapidly moving to keep their operations moving along as well they should have been doing. The pandemic was a period of real economic distress for people. A million people were evicted in the U.S. in 2020, and 9.6 million people lost their jobs. And what's less known is that a lot of these problems were playing out in court. So courts understood that it was critical to keep their operations moving. And the way that they did that is by using technology in a way they never had before. So our research found that between March and August of 2020, all 50 states and DC either allowed or required virtual hearings when almost no courts had been doing that prior to the pandemic, for example. So we really just saw a great explosion, and you saw an opportunity to look beyond ODR and portals and think about virtual hearings, things like e-filing, e-notarization. There's so many steps in a court case, even before it goes to a hearing, that need to happen that were being digitized really rapidly. And we wanted to understand on a broader scale the role that technology is going to play.
Yeah. And you decided to, or you focused the study on civil cases as opposed to criminal cases. Is there a reason for that? Was that because that was what your focus already had been before the pandemic, or was that why was it that you narrowed it in that way?
So our project is focused on the civil legal system, and for a couple of reasons. One is that in a criminal case, there is a right to a government-funded lawyer if you can't afford your own counsel. And that's not true in a civil case. So we have a lot of people in the civil legal system who have to navigate without a lawyer. Data from 2013 found that 3 in 4 civil cases involved at least one party who's not represented. And some of the most common types of lawsuits in the civil system include things like debt collection and eviction, which are what we sometimes refer to as business-to-consumer lawsuits. So it's often bigger business that has legal counsel that's suing an individual person who in 90% or more than 90% of the time, at least in debt and eviction cases, is not represented by a lawyer. And then there's also cases involving child support and family matters where you have two people going to court, and most of the time, either one or both of those people is not represented by a lawyer. And that's the majority of civil cases.
Yeah, I don't know what the numbers are nationally, but I remember working on a story about something in Utah where the numbers in Utah, I think something of the order of 80% of all cases in the state trial courts are debt of civil cases are debt collection cases. I don't know if that is in any way reflects what's going on a national level, but there's just a huge number of these cases.
Absolutely. Our research from our 2020 report on debt collection lawsuits found that debt collection cases were 1 in 9 of civil cases nationally in the 1990s. And by the 2010s, that was debt collection lawsuits are make up 1 in 4 civil cases. So there is definitely been an increase in these types of cases across the country.
Yeah, I don't want to jump around too much in the report, but one of the facts that was cited in this report in terms of its later in the report, we'll get to this. And I don't want to jump around, but you talk about kind of the disparate impact in some ways of the court's adoption of technology in that those who had lawyers, it better served those who were represented by lawyers in some cases than those who were not. And one of the examples you give is in these debt collection cases that the debt collectors were able to accelerate their filing of debt collection matters during the pandemic.
That's right. According to reporting from ProPublica that we included in our report, debt collectors were filing thousands of lawsuits using the benefit of e-filing or being able to file paperwork electronically to start these cases in bulk, really. But our research found that there were 8 states in which people without lawyers could not use electronic filing platforms to file their court paperwork. So that really creates a lot of imbalance. And we found similar trends in eviction cases. According to the Eviction Lab at Princeton, even though there was a lot of discussion about moratoria, there were often moratoria on the enforcement of eviction orders or the actual removal of people from their homes. But more than half of jurisdictions were still allowing landlords to file eviction cases. But our research found that in 9 states, people without lawyers could not electronically file paperwork with the courts in eviction cases. And we found something similar for child support. In 10 states, people without lawyers could not file requests for child support modifications electronically. So there was a great imbalance we noticed as we were digging into this more deeply.
Yeah. And actually, I guess as long as we're on that topic, another aspect of the imbalance was simply had to do with access to technology and access to broadband internet to begin with. A lot of people in this country, I think this continues to surprise people, and I'm in Massachusetts where this is still a problem in Massachusetts and people don't realize it, but there are a lot of people who just simply do not have access to broadband technology or to the best devices for accessing that broadband technology.
That's so true. As of 2018, 42 million U.S. adults did not have reliable access to broadband. And this was disproportionately true for Black and Hispanic communities, and as you mentioned, rural and tribal communities. And that can create real challenges when a court process moves online and it has significant consequences for your housing, you know, your debts, your family matters. And courts really did try to create some alternatives for people. So we found that 28 states and DC, for example, created physical drop boxes outside of courthouses so people could drop off paperwork. So if they couldn't access the internet to file electronically, they could have that alternative. Similarly, many courts allowed people to participate in online or virtual hearings telephonically rather than having to sign onto a video teleconference platform that would require a stronger internet connection.
Yeah. It's interesting because I, in my day job as a lawyer, I'm a lobbyist for the newspaper industry in Massachusetts, and one of the issues we lobby around is access to government meetings, open meetings laws, and of course those laws kind of took a hit in some ways during the pandemic because open meetings couldn't take place in physical circumstances. But, you know, accommodations were made to hold meetings virtually. And one of the probably one of the surprising side effects was that here in Massachusetts, and I think this has happened nationally, there's evidence that more citizens attended government meetings when they were virtual than would have attended them when they were purely physical, and that there were benefits for, you know, certain people, such as people with disabilities or people with childcare issues or those kinds of things, in being able to attend virtual meetings that that they wouldn't have been able to attend when they were physical. So I'm sure that happened to some degree with the courts as well. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. We definitely saw evidence of increased participation in some areas. And for all the reasons you mentioned, you know, in order to attend a court hearing previously, when courts were fully physical and in person, you know, you had to take off of work, you had to arrange for childcare, you had to travel to the courthouse, you had to pay for parking. And having a virtual option really eases some of those both financial and time burdens. And also, you know, we saw participation increases in the criminal system as well, even though our focus was on the civil system. So I find the most compelling example of this is New Jersey saw that in the first week of March of 2020, their no-show rate for criminal defendants was 20%. And by the week of March 16th, the week that the courts went online, that reduced to 0.3%, which is significant. And we found something very similar in civil proceedings. In Arizona, for example, the rate of default judgments, so an automatic ruling in favor of the plaintiff if the defendant fails to respond or to come to the hearing, dropped by 8% between 2019 and 2020. So we did see evidence of increased participation in some areas because of the benefits of online courts.
Yeah, that's huge. And we talked about debt collection cases. I mean, defaults are a huge problem in debt collection cases. And anything that can reduce that is significant.
That's really true. And prior to the pandemic, our 2020 report found that in the states where we had reliable data, 70% of debt collection lawsuits end in a default judgment. So this was a significant problem prior to the pandemic as well.
I'm speaking today with Kutsiya Naki, a lawyer who is part of the team at the Pew Charitable Trust that is studying modernization of the civil legal system in the United States, and which just released a report on how courts responded to the pandemic in their handling of civil cases. So far in this interview, we've talked about some of the downsides to that response, which included that courts' adoption of technology may have had a negative impact on many people who were not represented by lawyers or did not have access to the technology necessary to access the courts. But the report was not all bad news. In fact, far from it. Its principal conclusion was that courts rapidly embraced technology in the weeks and months after COVID forced them to shut down physical operations, and that they continued to modernize their operations in several ways. When we continue our discussion, we'll talk more about how courts responded to the pandemic and what courts still need to do to ensure they better serve all those who use their services. But first, let's hear about the sponsors who make this show possible. Busy lawyers need solutions that do the work for them in the background. Practice Panther is designed to help lawyers automate all aspects of their firm. The all-in-one platform offers a clean interface to manage your matters, track time, process e-payments, send documents for e-signature, and send business text messages to clients. Learn why Practice Panther is the preferred solution for tens of thousands of lawyers at PracticePanther.com. Welcome back to Law Next. When COVID-19 first swept across the United States in March 2020, it forced courts across the country to shut down, bringing trials and other legal matters to a screeching halt. A new study by the Pew Charitable Trusts examined how courts responded in the aftermath of that shutdown, and it concluded that they did pretty well overall, rapidly embracing technology and revolutionizing their operations. As I continue my conversation with Kutsiya Naki, one of the authors of the report, I ask whether she was surprised by how quickly courts adapted. So I guess I've been maybe focusing on some of the more negative findings of the report, but overall, the top level finding here was that courts adopted technology at an unprecedented speed and scale. Were you surprised by that at all?
It was surprising in many ways. Prior to the pandemic, courts were inching towards using technology, but at a pretty slow rate. So I can offer some examples of that. As I mentioned earlier, before the pandemic, almost no courts were using virtual hearings really at all in the civil court system. And even though prior to the pandemic, 37 states and DC had created e-filing mechanisms for people without lawyers, that happened over with a couple of states, you know, adopting that technology over the course of three decades between 1996 and 2019. And then in the first couple of months of the pandemic, our research found that 10 new states adopted e-filing mechanisms for people without lawyers almost overnight. So there was a sort of a slow movement towards technology. Another example is online dispute resolution. Between 2014 and 2019, ODR was adopted in about 66 jurisdictions across 12 states. So it was growing, but slowly. And so, you know, there was some signs of the courts moving towards this type of digitization, but nothing like what we saw in the first few months of the pandemic.
Yeah. I've referenced any number of times the legal futurist Richard Susskind, who happened to come out with a book on the future of the courts just before the pandemic struck, perhaps somewhat presciently on his part. And he makes the point in that book, he's made the point before, that the trouble with change, the difficulty around changing, modernizing technology in the courts is that the courts are so fast moving. I mean, they're just constantly going. And it draws an analogy to, you know, you can't change the tires on a moving vehicle. And the courts are constantly dealing with their caseloads they have. Increasing numbers of pro se litigants have, you know, put strains on clerks' offices and other resources. So, I mean, do you think that this was kind of the full stop that the courts needed to be able to do some radical modernization?
Absolutely. I always think of Michigan Chief Justice Bridget McCormick. She said something like, this escalation of the use of technology was not the disruption that courts necessarily wanted, but it was the disruption that they needed. And I think it really has, you know, jump-started this movement towards, you know, a more online future. In our report, we cite a survey from June of 2021 that found that the majority of judges that were surveyed believed that virtual hearings would be a fixture of the future of courts. And so I think court officials are really seeing this as an opportunity to modernize. And, you know, we definitely talk about what we can learn from this experience. I mean, it was laudable that the courts were able to bring their processes online so fast, keep their operations moving at a time when people really needed the courts to navigate these challenging financial and family waters. But I think there's a lot to be learned and improved upon in the future as well.
Yeah. You give an example in the report of Texas in terms of the sort of accelerated and dramatic adoption of technology. You give an example of Texas, which had never before conducted a video hearing in a civil court case before the pandemic. And then from April 1st to June 1st, 2020, conducted more than 122,000 video hearings. I think that was civil and criminal in that number. But that's pretty dramatic. Does video kind of represent the key point of the change in technology here, or does it go beyond conducting video hearings?
I think there's a lot to consider. As I mentioned earlier, there's so many processes that happen even before a hearing can occur, like filing paperwork, notarization of documents, and that need to be thought through in terms of what works and what doesn't. And, you know, we've offered a few recommendations in our report of how courts can think about technology in the context of what it is their mission to do, which is to have people be able to come, have their case heard by a judge, and then have a decision rendered that they believe is fair. So I think there's one of those recommendations is for courts to reimagine. So there's a risk of digitizing problems, right, that exist. Mm-hmm. So just putting online a process that's been in place for decades or sometimes even centuries. Notarization is a great example of that. But, you know, if you think through how to make those processes better, to make them more open, more efficient, more equitable for people, and then decide how you can leverage technology to achieve those goals, that can be really beneficial. And then also testing. So testing the technology with the litigants who are going to use it, taking their feedback, making improvements, and evaluating. So collecting, analyzing data. We talked about data at the top of this interview and how important it is, and using that to inform how courts are thinking about new technology installations, whether it's for hearings or filing or case management or whatever the case may be.
Yeah. So, I mean, it kind of sounds like you're urging courts to go through more of a design thinking process or something like that.
Absolutely.
I mean, look, get feedback from users, incorporate their feedback, look at process improvements, and then collect data and help use that data to help guide the decisions that they're going to be making around the use of technology. Do courts? Maybe the answer is in the evidence that we've seen already. But to what extent do courts have the budget and the resources and the staff to capitalize on what they've done here in terms of adopting technology?
That's an interesting question. We didn't reach those issues in the report per se, but one point I'd like to make from that is most people don't know that more than half of states have what are called decentralized court systems. So that means that budgeting and administration happens at a very local level. Mm-hmm. And so that also had an impact on how the technologies rolled out. We looked at Supreme Court emergency orders to get a sense of what the sort of governing bodies of courts were recommending. But ultimately, in many of those states, particularly those that are decentralized systems, it was up to the local jurisdiction to decide how to administer their operations during the pandemic, whether that was virtual hearings or instituting options to file paperwork by email or whatever it may be. So that's something we definitely saw. And some of the tools that courts can use to really be more thoughtful and, as you said, kind of use a design thinking mindset are not always so costly. So, for instance, bringing a group of litigants in to test, to user test, or embedding a survey or passing out surveys to users as they're exiting a particular process to get their feedback. So there's some pretty simple, low-cost options that courts can use that don't necessarily implicate, a large financial investment.
Right. I'm remembering, on this podcast early on in the pandemic, I had on a judge in Louisiana who I think has since become pretty well known for some of the technology he adopted in the courts that he managed, and did so kind of on a shoestring. He didn't have a lot of money. He used a lot of sort of off the shelf or even free and open source software for things like calendaring and video conferencing and document sharing and those kinds of things, and was able to implement some pretty dramatic changes in his courts fairly quickly and easily just by having just by improvising a little bit. That was Scott Schlegel. If anybody's wants to know more about him, so you've talked a number of times in this interview about kind of this disparate impact for people who were not represented by lawyers, also, people based on technology. You also said that the courts did not do very well, did not score very well on enhancing accessibility for people with disabilities or people with limited English proficiency. And I know you don't get into a lot of recommendations about this. I mean, as you talked about, just having different ways for e-filing or different methods for notarization. But do you have other thoughts on what courts should be thinking about in terms of making their systems more accessible to those for whom they are not currently accessible?
Definitely. And we, our report, we looked at nearly 10,000 orders that were gathered by researchers at Wesleyan University. They were emergency COVID orders from courts around the country. And we found that less than 3% of them mentioned resources or accommodations for people with limited English proficiency, and even fewer, less than 1.5% of these documents mentioned resources, accessibility, or accommodations for people with disabilities, and none of them mentioned technology accommodations for these groups. So if you were a person who was disabled or with limited English proficiency and you were looking for information about how you could access your court, you likely wouldn't find it. So one challenge is having, you know, information be accessible. And one of the things I mentioned is legal information portals, which is something we've also studied in the past. And those can be really great opportunities to create kind of understandable, plain language, easily searchable information for people online. And many states like Minnesota, Ohio, California have implemented these portals to help people navigate online, some of which have been hosted by courts. And, you know, one of our recommendations is to test. A really good example of this is Utah. So Utah has an online dispute resolution platform for small claims cases that they rolled out statewide, and they were able to engage researchers at the Innovation for Justice Lab at the University of Arizona to do an observation-based usability study. And they also were later able to get some resources to do an accessibility study of their platform. And they took the recommendations of those studies and they were able to implement improvements. And so, you know, user testing is a great way to make sure that you are thinking about various populations as you are designing systems and making sure that they're accessible.
Katsuya, what do you think is the takeaway from this report? What should people take away from it? What would you like to see happen with this information you've compiled?
That's a great question. I think the biggest takeaway, I think, is this idea that civil courts are really a consequential place where people's financial, family futures are decided. And, you know, therefore, having equitable, efficient, open access is really critical for a lot of the downstream consequences that people can experience as the result of a court case. And so I'd love to leave people with the idea that we need to think about our civil courts, think about them as a really critical player in people's lives, and make sure that people, especially those who don't have lawyers, have equal access.
There have so often been allusions to these silver linings in the pandemic in terms of some of the changes that the pandemic brought about. Are the courts an example of that? Are there, as you said, Justice McCormick talked about the fact that this is the change courts needed, even if it wasn't a change they wanted. Is this going to result positively in changes in the way the courts deliver and administer justice in this country?
We are certainly seeing that initially. You mentioned earlier the 2020 CCJ and COSCA, so the Conference of Chief Justices and the Conference of State Court Administrators, issued guiding principles on the uses of technology. And many states have developed task forces as well as their own standards. Michigan, for example, has their own statewide standards for the conduct of virtual hearings. So there's been a lot of effort to take the knowledge and the learnings of this experience. Pennsylvania's task force is thinking about what technologies worked, which should be kept, which should be set aside, maybe in favor of in-person processes. So there's a lot of conversation. As I mentioned, Utah is a good example of using data and evidence to drive change. Court systems in Michigan, Texas, and Florida are engaged with researchers to evaluate their online dispute resolution platforms. So we're seeing a real interest in courts of understanding how technology affects outcomes for people and how they can really use the opportunity to change their processes and make them better.
And I noted in the introduction to the report that you mentioned Utah several times, that Justice Simonis from the Utah Supreme Court was, I guess, a contributor in terms of sharing some insights and expertise in preparing this report. Somebody else who's been on this podcast and somebody else who's done a whole lot to change the administration of justice over the last few years.
Yeah, we were delighted to have his input, his insights, his wisdom as we were working on this project.
Well, before we wrap up, I'll give you the final word. Anything else you'd like to say about this report or leave our listeners with?
I'd love to leave your listeners with this idea that our legal system is a critical part of the ecosystem of our society, and having a strong sense of integrity in our court system is really critical. And technology holds a lot of promise, and we need to make sure that it's implemented in a thoughtful way moving forward.
And I should have asked what happens with your group, with your team, now that this report is out. I know you're ongoing in your work in terms of studying the civil legal system. So do you have a next project in mind, or where do you go from here?
As I mentioned earlier, we're working with researchers and state court partners on evaluations of online dispute resolution platforms, mm-hmm. and I'm very much looking forward to sharing those findings in the coming year as those studies complete. And we also are working with researchers at Indiana University who are partnering with the Indiana courts to do a quite extensive study of the experience of litigants in virtual hearings and eviction and debt collection cases. And so we're looking forward to sharing more on that as well.
Well, the report is a really fascinating read, and thank you so much for your work in compiling it and preparing it and writing it. Listeners can find it at pewtrust.org. And Katsiya, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really appreciated it.
Thank you for having me, Bob. It was a pleasure.
I've been speaking with Katsiya Naki, a lawyer and a member of the Civil Legal System Modernization Team at the Pew Charitable Trusts. We've been discussing Pew's report, How Courts Embraced Technology, Met the Pandemic Challenge, and Revolutionized Their Operations. You can find the full report available for free on pewtrust.org. What are your thoughts on today's show? Share them by tweeting us at LawNextPodcast. LawNext is produced, engineered, and edited by Populous Radio. I'm your host, Bob Ambrogi. I hope you'll join us again next time for another episode of LawNext.